Welcome to Propaganda Loves You, the show where we ask and answer the question, if fascism's so bad, why does it keep coming back? I'm Cody, your dictator for this week, and I'm joined by my co-dictators, oof, that never ends well, Arthur and Joe.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Propaganda Loves You. I'm Cody Olbert, your host for today's show, and I'm joined by my two co-hosts, Arthur and Joe. Since this is going to be one of our earlier episodes, we want to keep the material kind of light and approachable. So today we're going to talk about fascism. More specifically, propaganda tactics that have been employed by fascist regimes to accomplish their goals. But before we talk about that, if either of you were the dictator of America, what's your slogan and what false promises are you going to make to the American people?
Oh, wow. There's so much there. I was like excited about the hypothetical until you kept going and then like insinuated certain things. Like what kind of false promises are you going to give the American people? I was immediately just thinking, how can I just flip this whole thing upside down and give all the power away and get rid of all the hierarchies in one fell swoop and just be like, you know, I don't know. I don't have a slogan. Like, yeah, you asked about the slogan and that. Arthur, do you have thoughts? Because I'm just like all over the place with this right now.
I think it's something that I fantasize about a lot, but I don't think about the slogan and the promises. Yeah. Well, I think keep it simple, like hope, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's just like for a better future.
That would be solid. Any slogans, Joe? If we took away the requirement that you had to make false promises, what would your slogan be?
Anyone who is homeless, you have a home for free. There are plenty of them that are just vacant. They're yours, right? If they won't give you the keys, let us know. We got guys with guns. We'll come over there, make sure they let you in. Everybody has a home. And all doctors are federal employees with good benefits permanently, and just sign up to one of those doctors and start getting your health care, and it's free. And whole healthcare industry gone.
Okay, I like
you're
it.
Gone. No for-profit nonsense in the healthcare. No homelessness. Those would be two good, easy problems to take care of with dictators.
Yes. Yeah. Homes are free. Yeah. Homes and healthcare.
We have life. We're rich enough. We've got enough. We can make it happen for everybody. You know, live your life. Be happy.
All right. So so that was the first one. The second one should be a little bit quicker. This one's called Spot the Fake Slogan. So I'm going to give you guys five different slogans, and I'll tell you right off the bat. Two of them are fake, and then three are real. So
what do you mean by
spot
real?
The two fake ones. Like they're actual quotes.
From
slogans used by
a dictator person?
Yeah. Yep. All right. So I'll just read them all off and then you guys can let me know if you're ready to guess. So the first one is believe, obey, fight. The second one is one people, one empire, one ruler. One is tomorrow belongs to us. And number four is the strong will rise, the weak will fail. And then the last one is work sets you free.
I really hope that last one is fishy.
No, the last one's real. I feel like that's one of the ones I actually recognize.
Yep. You know that one, right?
Yeah, very dark. I feel like the only obvious fake I think I spotted is number four because the metaphors are mixed. It says the strong will rise and the weak will fail. It should be fall, right? If the metaphor is consistent.
True. And I actually messed that up. It should be fall. Will fall.
Yes. Nailed it.
What's the other one?
What about the one ruler? One empire, one people, one ruler.
One people, one empire, one ruler. That is actually true. It's ein Volk, ein Reich, ein Führer.
Yeah. Well, if you had said that.
Right. Forgot the other two.
Believe, obey, fight. And the other one is tomorrow belongs to us.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that one sounds kind of vague enough to, like, I feel like the fascists are actually kind of specific when they start saying things.
Yeah. Like, yep. Yeah. That is the other fake one. That's actually from Cabaret. back to our main topic for today. So most of this episode is going to focus on historical regimes like Germany, Italy, the more well-known fascist regimes. We'll also talk about Spain a little bit. But, you know, when most people think about fascism, they're probably thinking about military power, secret police, or mass surveillance. But generally, that's not really how fascism starts. Before fascism can rule with an iron fist, it has to win the hearts and minds of the people, or at least enough of the people to put the fascists in power. Fascism isn't just a system of government. It's a belief system. It's a story. And the people who sell that story don't start with fear and violence. They start with hope. They tell you that your country was once great and it's been betrayed, that outsiders and traitors have stolen your future. And most importantly, they tell you only one man or only one movement can restore your honor. They promise jobs, prosperity, and safety. They promise that if you obey and if you trust the leader, everything will be great again. To understand how fascism rises, we have to go back to the days before Mussolini, before Hitler, before the world learned the hard way just how deadly these ideas could be. We have to look at how fascists use propaganda to sell a dream and how once that dream takes hold, they're able to translate that into power. So to talk about the rise of fascism, we need to start at the end of World War I. While the end of a war usually starts the beginning of some kind of peace, in the case of World War I, it was the beginning of chaos. The war had shattered empires, bankrupted economies, and left millions dead. Across Europe, nations were unrecognizable from what they had been just 5 years earlier, and in the wreckage, ordinary people were desperate for answers. In Germany, inflation was so extreme by 1923 that a loaf of bread could cost hundreds of billions of marks, and the middle class was basically wiped out overnight. In Italy, war veterans had returned home to find an economy in crisis and a government that was too weak to handle the fallout. And in Spain, political factions were basically on the brink of civil war. Almost every major European country faced the same question, which is like, who's responsible for the situation that we're in? And this is really the moment where fascism thrives, right? It's not in times of strength, but in times of weakness. The first promise of fascism isn't power, it's stability. It tells people that their suffering isn't random, that someone is to blame for this, and that there is only one way to restore order. A newspaper in Italy at this time ran, "Italy needs a strong leader. Mussolini rises." And then that was pretty much what it took in that scenario. You know, in 1919, Mussolini saw his opportunity. Italy was in crisis. There were strikes, riots, and food shortages. The government seemed weak and ineffective, and Mussolini offered a very simple solution. You know, follow me and I will make Italy great again. And, you know, Mussolini didn't invent fascism overnight. He, you know, branded it. He called his movement Fasci de we might just re-record that part. Combattimento? Yeah, I don't know about that one. Anyway.
No, I think people want to hear you pronounce the Italian words and like exactly. Working through it as part of it. You got to say it to the best of your ability and then we get to how you say it.
All right. That's fair. He called his movement the Fasci de Combattimento. That's what we're going with. All right, perfect. Yeah.
Yeah, the hand gesture, of course.
I'm basically Gorlami. Okay. This is a reference to ancient Roman fasces, which is like a bundle of rods tied around an axe, which symbolized unity and strength. This is kind of where the word fascism originally came from, right? Mussolini coined that. But unity through what? Strength for whom, right? The details didn't really matter, not yet anyway. What matters was the illusion of power. And Mussolini understood propaganda instinctively. Like he staged massive spectacles like the exhibition of fascist revolution, which was a propaganda event dramatizing Italy's recent history to cast fascism basically as the nation's savior. His face was everywhere. It was in newspapers, on billboards, in school books. He cultivated the image of a tireless leader, personally overseeing public works, posing shirtless while farming, or standing atop tanks. The press, largely controlled by his allies, pushed the narrative that Italy had found its savior. And across the border in Germany, Adolf Hitler was watching very closely. He saw how Mussolini was able to use fascism as a spectacle, as a movement bigger than just one man, and he wanted to do the same for Germany. Similar to Italy, you know, Germany's defeat in World War I had left the country in ruin. The Treaty of Versailles had humiliated the German people, stripping them of their military, and forcing them to pay crushing reparations. As the economy collapsed, Hitler and his newly formed Nazi party began whispering the same words that Mussolini had used. You know, you've been betrayed. You deserve better. You know, follow me. I will fix this. His speeches weren't just political. They were performances. He modeled his rallies after religious ceremonies, using symbols, flags, and synchronized marches to create a feeling of unity or of destiny. He repeated simple slogans, Ein Volk, ein Reich, ein Führer, one people, one empire, one leader, until they became scripture. For fascism to work, there must always be a villain, right? Mussolini had his communists and anarchists. Hitler took it even further. Jews, socialists, intellectuals, anyone who questioned the movement became an enemy of the people. The propaganda machine went into overdrive, rewriting history in real time to justify basically what was coming next. And in hindsight, it's easy to see fascism for what it was, a violent, oppressive regime built on lies. But at the time, it didn't feel that way to everyone. It felt like hope. It felt like order. It felt like power. The people who supported Mussolini and Hitler in the beginning weren't necessarily all monsters. Many of them just were desperate. They had watched the country collapse, their savings disappear, their future stolen. And when someone came along and said, I can fix this, I can make it great again, it didn't sound like a threat to them. It sounded like salvation. But fascist propaganda doesn't just sell a dream. It also sells an enemy. And once enough people believe in that dream, they're willing to do anything to protect it, even if it means destroying democracy itself. Germany had made its choice, and the world was about to learn what happens when propaganda turns into reality. So one thing I want to note, while Mussolini coined and invented fascism, it didn't mean these tactics weren't used prior to Mussolini. You could go back and look at Napoleon in France and many other imperialist countries or authoritarian regimes prior to Mussolini and identify the same tactics that are being used by fascists. But, you know, Mussolini took it one step further in creating an actual political ideology around it. So we are going to talk about this a little bit probably at the end, but, you know, I think this is a good point to pause and just ask you guys, you know, based off of the situation that was occurring in Italy and Germany at the time prior to fascism really taking hold, are there any parallels you can think of, anything that you can draw to like current situation and where we are in the world today?
I think, you know, in terms of its relatability today, the promise of revival really stood out to me. And also, like, you know, you said that Mussolini's friends were controlling the media. And I think that that's when fascism really thrives, is when media is under control of the oligarchs. And then, of course, you have the alignment with, yeah, promise of revival. And that's like exactly what is happening today.
I was also, when you were talking about Italy and mentioning how Hitler was kind of watching Mussolini for his notes and figuring out what works or what doesn't. In retrospect, I'm not a World War II buff, but I feel like if, when I think about the so-called bad guys, because I say so-called because the US and Britain did a lot of bad shit in World War II as well, but the bad side, I typically think of Germany and Japan. I don't often think about Italy as much. You know, I think about the Nazis and the Holocaust, and I think about what was going on in the Pacific. Those are like the two main things that I think about. So I just think it's kind of interesting that Mussolini was sort of like the guy that started stirring the pot and got Hitler all curious about how he could, you know, copy these tactics or whatever. And now, history wise, we don't really talk about Mussolini as much as we talk about Hitler. So, And for precedent, like you said, Mussolini is sort of the start of the word fascism, but we can sort of go back further and look at other examples that, you know, we can retrospectively point out as fascism, even if the concept didn't exist. That's sort of anachronistic, but it's an important thing. And I was thinking, who was the first real, like, American fascist president we've had? And I immediately thought of Andrew Jackson. You know what I mean? Just like how angrily he went after just the indigenous people in the States and what the culture must have been like around him at the time. Right.
Yeah. So, like, two things, Joe, on the Mussolini comment, because Hitler's like the guy that saw an idea in, like, is he like the Mark Zuckerberg in this scenario to Mussolini's Winklevoss, right? Like those twins. It is interesting. Like, we'll talk a little bit about how, you know, despite the fact that Mussolini might have started fascism as we know it, his country was not as prepared as Germany's was for what they were about to go into. The other thing that kind of stuck out to me for this too is something that I don't think I thought about until much more recently in life. And when I go back to thinking about like 2016 as an example, and how did Trump get elected the first time? And I think about some of the concerns that were raised about globalization and manufacturing jobs leaving the US. That had no effect on me just because of what I was doing, right? Like that had no impact on me, but that definitely had a huge impact on a lot of people in the United States, right? They were losing their jobs, losing the ability to work. So some of it going overseas, but then also just where did pensions go? Where did financial stability for one person to run their house go, right? Like after researching this, it almost makes more sense to me, like how we kind of got to where we are now. Please stay tuned for a word from our sponsors. America needs a leader who tells it like it is. Someone who doesn't waste time with things like equality or free thought. Someone who knows that strength is more important than democracy. That's why you should vote for Remington Steele, the only candidate brave enough to say what we're all thinking. Other politicians pretend to care about the Constitution. Remington only cares about power. You want results? He's going to get them by any means necessary. Under Remington's leadership, you can expect a military parade every week, loyalty pledges from every citizen starting in kindergarten, stronger borders, stronger laws, and even stronger secret police. Look, democracy had a good run, but let's be honest. Do you really want your neighbors making decisions? A vote for Remington is a vote to make America strong again. This message was paid for by billionaires, foreign oligarchs, and corporate interests through unlimited dark money donations to the Deceive America PAC and cannot legally be endorsed by any candidate. But Remington Steele doesn't care about laws, rules, or democracy, and he endorses this message anyway. So we just finished up on post-World War I, pre-World War II. So now by this time, it's like the mid-1930s, you know, fascism was no longer a political movement fighting for relevance, but it was the law of the land at this point, right? Mussolini and Hitler had dismantled their respective democratic institutions, silenced opposition, and turned their nations into one-party states. Their early promises of economic revival and national greatness had actually worked initially. They had won the hearts and minds of millions in their country, and now it was their job to basically keep them. For the fascist regime to survive, it wasn't enough just to control the government. They had to control the reality for their citizens. Mussolini's total takeover of the media, he understood that a dictatorship wasn't just about force, but it was also about belief. People had to believe in the state and the leader and the inevitability of victory. But belief didn't happen naturally. It had to be crafted, shaped, and repeated. Mussolini turned the entire Italian media into a propaganda machine. By 1926, Mussolini had bought, intimidated, or banned nearly every independent newspaper in Italy. The few that remained printed only what the government allowed. Schools rewrote history textbooks to portray Mussolini as Italy's savior, and every major film studio, radio station, and theater company received directives on what stories they could tell. Any play or film that didn't glorify Mussolini simply never got made. And at the heart of Mussolini's propaganda machine was the image of the leader. You know, as mentioned before, you know, he was staging photo ops where he's harvesting wheat or building roads or standing shirtless and muscular like a Roman statue brought to life. Every public appearance was carefully choreographed to reinforce one message, and that's basically that Mussolini is Italy and Italy is Mussolini. He didn't just control what people saw, but how they saw it. Looking at, you know, the Nazi propaganda machine, and while Mussolini's propaganda emphasized spectacle, Hitler and his minister of propaganda, Joseph Goebbels, Goebbels? I know I've heard.
Yeah, I like that last one the best. Goebbels. Whichever one is most sinister, say it that way.
Yeah. Goebbels. Okay. Yeah. So Mr. Joseph Goebbels, he took things further, right? He rewrote reality itself. Goebbels didn't just want people to follow the Nazi party. He wanted them to believe that anything outside of the Nazi party was treason, right? Newspapers, books, and films that questioned Nazi ideology were banned or burned. History was rewritten to fit the Nazi narrative. Hitler, like Mussolini, was painted as Germany's savior, while Jews, socialists, and intellectuals were demonized as enemies of the state. Goebbels' most dangerous weapon was actually radio. At the time, radio was the most powerful mass communication tool in history. Unlike newspapers or speeches, though, radio didn't require literacy, so anyone could listen, and listen they did. The Nazi government's mass-produced cheap government-issued radios, I'm going to try and pronounce it, called Volksempfänger. I think that's actually pretty close. Okay. Which are also known as like the people's receivers. And these were sold at low prices so that every German household could basically buy one and tune in. But the catch was the radios could only pick up state-approved broadcasts. So like super cheap, easy like access method of getting information directly to people, but it's only going to be putting out the information that they want. Every night, families gathered around the radios to hear Hitler's speeches and Goebbels' announcements. It wasn't just a source of information, but it was basically a lifeline directly to the regime. One of the most infamous tactics the Nazis used was the big lie. The idea was simple. So it was basically tell a lie so massive, so audacious that people would just assume it's true. It wasn't enough to claim that Jews were a problem. Nazis declared that Jews were the problem, that they controlled banks, orchestrated Germany's downfall in World War I, and secretly worked to destroy the country from within. It didn't matter that none of that was true. What matters was how many people believed it, and millions of people did. Which really brings us to like a major strategy with fascism, right? Fascism needs enemies. No fascist regime can survive without that. The promise of fascism, that it's going to bring strength, order, and prosperity, only works if people believe that someone else took those things away from them. Mussolini blamed communists and socialists. Hitler blamed Jews, intellectuals, and liberals. And then Francisco Franco of Spain, who was Spain's fascist dictator after the Civil War, blamed leftist Republicans and anarchists. The pattern was the same everywhere fascism took root. You know, scapegoating served two purposes. One, it gives people a target for their frustrations. If you were struggling to find work or food, it was easier to blame the traitors within than to ask whether the government itself was responsible. Second, it justified state violence. Once a group had been labeled as enemy of the state, any action against them, such as censorship, exile, imprisonment, or even genocide, became a necessity. In Nazi Germany, scapegoating escalated to terrifying levels. Propaganda posters, films, and books dehumanized Jews, portraying them as parasites, criminals, and conspirators. Even children's stories were rewritten to warn against the Jewish threat. Germans were taught from an early age that violence against Jews wasn't just acceptable, it was self-defense. In Italy, Mussolini's scapegoating wasn't as racially motivated, at least not at first. His initial targets were communists and political dissidents, but when Italy aligned itself with Nazi Germany, he embraced Hitler's racial policies, passing anti-Semitic laws in 1938, that stripped Italian Jews of their rights, despite the fact that Jews had lived in Italy for centuries. Franco's Spain followed a different path. Instead of targeting specific ethnic groups, Franco painted his political enemies as existential threats. His propaganda framed the Spanish Civil War as a battle between true Spaniards and red anarchist traitors. Any resistance to his rule was labeled as terrorism. This is what fascist propaganda does. It doesn't just create supporters, it creates fanatics. By 1939, Mussolini and Hitler had reshaped their societies into total propaganda states. Newspapers, films, and schools had all been repurposed into tools of the regime. Alternative viewpoints had been eliminated, and to question the leader was to betray the nation. And yet, for many, fascism still felt like a success. The economy seemed to be improving, national pride had been restored, the streets were orderly, crime was down. It didn't matter that dissenters were being arrested, that books were being burned, and that entire communities were being erased from history. To the average Italian, German, or Spaniard, fascism looked like it was working. But obviously, appearances can be deceiving because even as Mussolini and Hitler held their nations with an iron grip, the larger truth was beginning to unfold. The reality of fascism, specifically the violence, the war, and the totalitarian cruelty, was about to become impossible to ignore. And the world was about to learn that propaganda had its limits. Please stay tuned for a word from our sponsors. In today's world, thinking for yourself is hard. That's why there's Obet, the revolutionary social media platform that does the thinking for you. Tired of reading conflicting news?
Obey filters out all the noise, so you only see what's officially true. With our patented cognitive compliance algorithm, you'll receive only the most approved opinions, carefully curated for your safety and convenience. And Obey isn't just an app, it's a loyalty program. Stay in line and earn loyalty credits. And who knows, maybe one day you won't be the one getting reported. Obey, because thinking is dangerous. Now with 24/7 biometric tracking, because if you have nothing to hide, you have nothing to fear.
So after World War One, after Hitler and Mussolini took power, obviously the main goal from that point initially was consolidating power internally, right? Silencing dissent internally. This gave them an internal enemy to fight and blame while they took control of their respective countries. So once internal control is established, you still need an enemy to blame and conflict to point to as a proof of strength, which inevitably leads to greater conflict. All about consolidating power and bringing that to the executive branch. I mean, the dictator of each of those countries.
Branch, it's slipping out. You can't control it.
Is there a parallel there? What are you thinking of?
I guess like what I think about, well, obviously scapegoating, right? Like that's an easy thing to point to. Like who's to blame for everything that's happened recently? I mean, what we're recording this near the end of February. What plane crash over the last 2 weeks has been DEI related or something like that, right?
What a weak scapegoat, though. Like this DEI thing is just like, as far as fascism goes, classically, such a weak scapegoat. Like Mussolini and Hitler were dealing with people who actually wanted to take power from, like, communists actually want to dismantle the fascists and institute a different kind of government, and ditto with socialists and anarchists or whatever. DEI is just like, hey, people are mean to us a lot, and we'd really like it if we could just like not be, you know, picked on, and we could get jobs, and we can like live a normal life without getting made fun of for sexuality or race or whatever. And they're like, in general, pretty calm group of people, the people who benefit from DEI. I mean, statistically, white women are the biggest beneficiaries of DEI. But that's besides the point. It's just kind of like a weak scapegoat. You're picking on DEI. It's weird. It's not a scary boogeyman to point to, you know. You're saying it's funny.
Yeah, I think like the immigration being a scapegoat. Obviously, like I mean, that was since 2016 that we've talked about that. I mean, there's legitimate things you could talk about there. Like we probably do need to work on our immigration policies in the U.S. But that aside, like. The DEI piece is interesting to me because, like, I don't even think that's they need someone to blame internal to the United States. And I think, like, they just can't say what they want to. And so, or at least not yet. Like, and so, like, this is their doublespeak, right?
Yeah. That's why all their hand gestures are just accidents and spasms for now.
It's just a stim. Yeah.
It's pretty funny that they would sell cheap radios and then do state-run media. I'm pretty surprised that they don't do that today, where like you can go get a cheap OLED TV and it's all Fox News.
Yeah, that's what you were talking about, the radios, and I immediately was thinking, like, there was a phrase you used to describe radio at the time as like the most something form of communication, or there was a phrase that you said that stuck out to me. It was
at the time, radio was the most powerful mass communication tool in history.
Mass communication tool. Yes. The most powerful mass communication tools in history today are what? Not cable news, not newspapers, not legacy media. It's Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, X, whatever.
Yep.
And just convenient that your buddies happen to own those things. You know?
Yeah.
Just super convenient.
Happened to purchase the largest social media network, what, 2 years before the election? Just happened to. Accidentally, actually, I think it was.
No like, goal in mind.
Yeah. I was really forced into that one.
Well, at least we're not at the point in history yet where it's like the Mussolini movies and it's Trump is like Iron Man in the Marvel movies or something.
I mean, like cringe art is unbearable.
Well, that's what I was going to mention. I think you were just about to say it too, Joe, but like, yeah, how many AI pictures of Elon Musk or Trump do you see like in Roman like armor or like super jacked with a bald eagle on their shoulder or something like that? Like it was strange to me, like, seeing it, but it makes more sense now, right? Like, because they can't actually go out and do those photo shoots, but they can totally write a prompt and get some weird AI art. All right. So we talked through kind of like pre-World War II. You know, at this point, Mussolini and Hitler had really consolidated power for their respective countries. And so, like, by 1939, the fascist vision of a revived powerful empire had been sold to millions. Mussolini and Hitler convinced their people that the future belonged to them, that their nations, once humiliated, would now rise above all others. You know, the propaganda had done its job. The people were loyal. The enemies had been identified. All that remained was the final inevitable step here, which was war. Fascist leaders did not stumble into global conflict. They walked into it willingly, deliberately, you know, and with the full force of their propaganda machines behind them. The entire ideology of fascism was built on expansion, domination, and restoration of a mythic past. You know, to stay in power, Hitler and Mussolini had to deliver on their promises. They had told their people that the world had conspired against them, that treason and weakness had brought their countries to ruin, and that only by striking back could they reclaim their rightful place. The Nazis, having spent years conditioning Germans to believe that war was not only necessary, but righteous, invaded Poland in 1939. German newspapers and radio broadcasts framed the invasion as an act of self-defense. Hitler declared that Germany had been forced into action, that Polish aggression had left them no choice. In reality, the invasion had been planned well in advance, a calculated move to launch the war that fascist propaganda had spent years justifying. As a quick aside, I know this isn't about Germany or the story that we're telling right now, but if you just think about the invasion into Ukraine by Russia, what was like the initial justification? It's, well, this is national security because we can't have a NATO country right on our border, and therefore we're justified in attacking this sovereign country, right? So you can see parallels, and we'll definitely talk more about Russia in the future. So unlike the Nazis in Germany, Mussolini was not as prepared as they were for war. His carefully curated image of strength masked an uncomfortable truth that Italy, as a country, was not ready for war. The Italian military was underfunded, ill-equipped, and lacking in leadership. But backing down at this point was not an option. Mussolini had promised an empire. He had told the Italian people that they were destined to rule the Mediterranean, that Italy would reclaim the glory of ancient Rome. And so even as military strategists warned him of disaster, Mussolini led Italy into war. Fascist propaganda made it impossible to admit failure. As Italian troops struggled in North Africa and Greece, Mussolini's newspapers printed headlines declaring victory. Radio broadcasts assured Italians that their soldiers were unstoppable, that their leaders were brilliant tacticians. Even as battlefield defeats mounted, the propaganda machine continued spinning its narrative of triumph. But reality had begun to catch up. In Germany, Hitler faced a similar problem. The early years of the war had gone exactly as his propaganda had promised. You know, Poland had fallen in weeks, France had been conquered in a matter of months, and Hitler's popularity soared. You know, he was a genius, the newspapers declared. The Third Reich was unstoppable, and then came the Eastern Front. The invasion of Soviet Union was basically Hitler's greatest gamble, a military campaign fueled by the same ideological propaganda that brought him into power. Germans had been told that Bolshevism was a disease, that the Slavic peoples were inferior, that victory in the East was inevitable. But as the war dragged on and German troops found themselves outmatched by the vast resources and brutal winners of Russia, even the most loyal Nazis began to see the cracks. Goebbels, ever the master of manipulation, refused to let the public accept the truth. The Reich's newspapers did not report on the catastrophic losses in Stalingrad. Instead, they doubled down on stories of heroism, on tales of German soldiers standing firm against overwhelming odds. Hitler's speeches did not acknowledge the failures of his strategy. Instead, they called for total war, demanding that every German man, woman, and child commit themselves to the fight. But propaganda can only hold back realities for so long.
And by 1944, the truth had become undeniable. German cities were being bombed daily, and there was no victory in sight for the Third Reich, despite their best efforts in propaganda. And we will get into what happened next, next week in part 2.